You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stacey DeRasmo's third novel, The Sky Below, is the story of Gabriel Collins, a struggling, dissatisfied obituary writer trying to find himself in a post-9/11 world. Ms. DeRasmo's work, which is notable for its rich poetic prose, has received quite a bit of critical praise, including a rave front-page review in yesterday's New York Times Book Review. The Sky Below is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm delighted that it has brought Stacey DeRasmo back to the show today. Hi.
Hi.
And you describe this book as being a sort of metamorphosis of the sort that Ovid was interested in or the kind that Kafka was interested in.
Well, really, I would say more the kind that Ovid was interested in. He was really my...
No cockroaches.
Yeah. No cockroaches. He was one of my main inspirations for the book. I don't have any classical background. I'm not a classical scholar, but I read the Metamorphoses, Ovid's Metamorphoses, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Picked it up when I was on vacation, and it was just phenomenally inspiring to me. And I began to think about what would a modern-day metamorphosis look like.
So that actually started you thinking about this book. Well, although you've written about transformations before.
To some degree. And this character actually had had an earlier incarnation many, many years ago before I even published my first book. I had had a character who was a kind of a ever so slightly shady. He was the death editor at a publishing house, which I thought was just the most brilliant idea anyone had ever had.
You made him a little more prosaic, an obituary writer.
Well, exactly. And that other project kind of never really worked, and I put it aside and wrote 2 other books. And then in a slightly different form, he came back to me after I had read Ovid. And that idea of a slightly shady striver in New York was one that I really wanted to work with.
Well, it's there have been characters like this before. André Gide loved this kind of character where you're both appalled by his behavior, but you like him at the same time.
Exactly. And, you know, I think Gabriel is not... He doesn't do things quite as bad as what maybe André Gide's characters did.
Although he does have certain similarities.
He has certain similarities. And, I mean, The Immoralist actually is one of my favorite books. And I think that literature can be incredibly interesting when it engages you with a character who does things that are a bit outside of what most of us would usually do.
That's part of the trick, isn't it, to allow, to give him all of these negative qualities and at the same time keep the reader liking him on some level. Do you have to keep on liking him as well?
I liked him the whole time. I mean, I have to say, to me, he was always a beautiful and melancholy boy. And in many ways, not to sort of spoil my own, be a spoiler of my own book, but the book in many ways is about his redemption. It's about his kind of descent down, and then actually his regeneration and coming back up into something a little less shady than he was before. I always had tremendous tenderness for him.
Well, this is another transformation, which was something that we saw in Tea and A Seahorse Year. In Tea, Isabel, the main character, tries on new identities after her mother's suicide. In A Seahorse Year, a family's transformed by the breakdown of their teenage son.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find that I've always been very, very interested in is characters who are pushed really past their limits by circumstances that are outside of their control. And Gabriel is one of those characters. He has... a meltdown on many levels, a spiritual meltdown, a physical meltdown, a kind of an economic meltdown. And this pushes him to shapeshift and to change.
How soon did you find the voice? Because that usually is the key to success in a story as complicated as this.
Yeah, it took a while. It was a sweaty business. I definitely he and I wrestled quite a bit. And I felt in a way that I had to woo him and really get to know him. And he really is not like me. And so I had to sort of keep approaching him until I found the note that I wanted.
He's a 37-year-old writer and artist, and you've decided to tell the story from his point of view. Mm-hmm. How would you describe his sexuality?
I would say that he is mostly gay with a bit of a wiggle. I guess
because he is involved with a woman.
Yeah, he gets involved with a woman in the middle of the book. And actually, in previous drafts, he was even more fluid than that. He kind of traveled very lightly and easily between men and women.
A shapeshifter.
He was a shapeshifter. And then in subsequent drafts, that felt a little too easy or a little too abstract, and so I just basically made him, you know, gay with a twist.
But this is also something that you have dealt with in the past. In A Seahorse Year, mm-hmm. we have Christopher being raised by his lesbian mother, Nan, and her longtime partner, Marina, but he spends a couple of days a week with his biological father, who's a gay man named Hal.
Yeah. Yeah. In all of these cases, for me, sexual identity is never the issue of the books. It's more background. I think I'm very, very used to, I'm probably spoiled by living in New York, but I'm very used to living in a sort of a sexually pluralistic world. And so the worlds that I make are also very sexually pluralistic. I usually have a lot of different kinds of people.
And as we said, he also engages in some pretty awful behavior. He's a grifter. He's a thief. He even steals from his friends.
Yeah.
He's a drug dealer.
Yeah.
He turns tricks in men's rooms.
Yeah.
And yet we like
him. We do. Because the reason that he does all these things, and this is what was really key to me, in his mind, is for beauty. It's for the sake of beauty. He wants money to make beautiful things.
He organizes his life in boxes.
Yes.
And is that something of an act of art creation like Joseph Cornell, or is it more overtly psychological? Do Gabriel's boxes help him cope with problems that are too big for him to handle?
Right. Probably a bit of both. I mean, he begins by what he does is he breaks into people's houses, but then instead of he takes things, but he moves them around to other houses where he thinks they would go better. I've often said that being an artist is like being a thief who puts things into your house, which is what Gabriel does. And then he moves on to making little box dioramas that he keeps under the bed. And then once he gets a little bit of art education and sees the work of Joseph Cornell, he decides that he could do that, although in his mind, of course, he thinks he could do it, you know, better.
Well, many people attempt to compartmentalize certain aspects mm-hmm. of their lives. Is this something that Gabriel's doing?
I would say more that he's trying to create alternate worlds that are more beautiful and more resonant and more patterned than the one that we live in.
And that's because the story takes place in post 9/11 Manhattan.
Partly, yeah. I mean,
he calls it the city of the dead.
Yes, he works down on Wall Street, which to him, since 9/11, feels like the city of the dead. And for me, one of the things that 9/11 did aesthetically for me as a writer is that it really changed my sense of scale. And the idea that there might be these enormous forces over which we have no control suddenly reaching in and breaking the frame, that was what really, really interested me about 9/11.
Well, Gabriel says he's waiting for the gods to change him. I'm not sure what gods we're talking about. Are we talking about Zeus, Athena, Mars, and the rest of the Mount Olympus crowd?
Yeah, sure. And he'd be, you know, Gabriel, he's kind of equal opportunity, so he'd probably throw in some Hindu gods and, you know, kind of whatever he can get.
But in those Greek writings, mm-hmm. the gods control many of our actions. Mm-hmm. We don't have total control mm-hmm. over our lives.
That's right, which we don't. And I think that one of the things that's been very, very moving to me in the past maybe in the years since 9/11, is how many enormous global things have happened, the tsunami, the global economic meltdown that we're in now, Hurricane Katrina, these phenomenally big events that compared to which human beings look really quite small. That's really been a feature of modern life within the last 10 years.
Well, since we opened talking about metamorphosis and mm-hmm. transformation, do you think that New York has been transformed permanently because of the destruction of the World Trade Center, or have we kind of returned back to where we were pre 9/11 in most cases?
I think that it has changed the city. I think that it may have changed the city in a way on a spiritual level, on a soul level. I think that that the city, it's as if there's a ring in the bark of the city now. And especially if you were here during 9/11, there's a way in which it changed the experience of being in this place forever. New York, in many ways, had not been touched like that before. You know, cities in Europe obviously have, but
yeah, we felt invulnerable.
We have felt invulnerable, and suddenly we understood that we were part of history.
And I speak to people who say, you know, I'm afraid to live in the downtown area or in Brooklyn Heights because of what happened. A friend who lived in Brooklyn Heights,
right,
and who said that, you know, the fallout from the the destruction affected her life and her child's life for quite a long time.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, these enormous things, these enormous structures that you think are impervious do fall. It just so happened that about 2 weeks after 9/11, I was in Rome, and my partner and I were walking through the Roman Forum, and it felt like such a perfect lesson to what we had just experienced. You know, empires fall.
Actually, the Roman Forum is in better shape than... This is your third novel in 9 years. Mm-hmm. They take you 3 years to write?
They've each taken me just about 4 years to write. I'm not quite sure why. It's the length of a college education, you know, the acquisition of language. I have no idea. But they've seemed to be on this sort of four-year pattern.
Well, in this case, you have an awful lot of detail about criminal activity. I'm sure there was a lot of research that you did.
No, I honestly just made that stuff up.
Really?
Yeah, really. I don't know how to do any of those things. I basically just sort of imagined it. Although even some of my closest friends sort of winked and said to me, you broke into houses like that, didn't you? And I honestly really never have.
And you're juggling writing with teaching at Columbia.
Right.
Do you get up every morning at 5 o'clock like some people?
No, I tend to divide my time between writing days and teaching days. On days that I'm teaching, I really need to be there fully.
Well, everybody remarks at just how beautiful your writing is.
Thank you.
Critics have called it luminous, poetic, exquisite.
Thank you.
Are these things that you can teach students to do?
Well, you can't teach students to do it, but you can show students that you value it, that you think that they're important, and that they move you when you hear them. You know, you can give... I think sometimes beauty gets short shrift in, you know, critically and in the classroom as if it's sort of icing on the top of the cake. But beauty is really an integral part of... It's the music of language and of image.
Well, you also have reviewed books over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking for that beauty, or do you try to take the book as it's given to you?
Well, it's like the Yeats poem, right? I love you for your yellow hair. I love the books for what they talk about and what they're interested in, and of course I love them for their yellow hair.
You say that the books take you 4 years, so that means you're working on one right now, even though you're doing the tour.
Yeah, started. I've started one. Yeah.
And do you have a pretty good idea of how it's going to develop?
I do, actually. They come to me, each book comes to me in a fairly strong way. They kind of announce themselves. So I do have a good sense of what the next one is.
Stacy DeRasmo is the author of Tea, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, A Seahorse Year, which was notable, San Francisco Chronicle and Newsday, and was the winner of the Lambda Literary Award. Her latest, which has gotten incredible reviews so far, congratulations,
thank you,
is called The Sky Below. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And it is, as always, a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.